background. Regrettable, but inevitable. Part of the complex inheritance of a troubled country, and possibly, it is hoped, to be rectified when the new civilian government takes power. In an attempt to gain support abroad, two of the remaining leaders of GAM, Ninith de Garcia and Erlindo Ideo de Aquino, traveled to Europe in March and April 1986 after the inauguration of the elected civilian president, Christian Democrat Vinicio Cerezo. One of their most important messages was that killings and disappearances had not abated at all during the first 3 months of Cerezo's presidency, and that the death squads had actually reappeared and were active in Guatemala City. Because of ill health, Ninith de Garcia canceled her visits in Washington, D.C., and flew directly from Europe to Chicago, where she was scheduled to receive the key to the city from Mayor Harold Washington. As she went through customs in Chicago, however, the officials of the Immigration and Naturalization Service searched, interrogated, and harassed her for 2 hours, one of the customs officials calling her a subversive and a communist. They also seized literature she carried and threatened to deport her, despite her intended brief stopover and valid visa. This intimidation had its effect, and Ninith de Garcia flew directly to Guatemala. A friend attended the banquet in her place to accept the key presented by Mayor Washington. This incident is revealing. It is unlikely that Sharansky or Valenza would be so treated by the INS, but if by some chance they were, the press outcry would be great. When a press conference was held in Chicago by supporters of GAM to protest this outrage, the major media did not attend, and neither the press releases nor the follow-up letter from a congressional group signed by Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan could break the silence. The convergence between Reagan administration policy toward Guatemala and media priorities was complete. According to two organizers of the Chicago press conference, full information on this event was given Steve Greenhouse, the New York Times reporter in Chicago, but not a word about this incident appeared in the newspaper of record. A press release by the Guatemalan Army on September 17, 1986, accused GAM of conducting a black campaign of falsehood, insults, and insolence directed at the military institution that exceed the boundaries of liberty and tolerance for free speech. The Army cannot permit the insidiousness and truculence of GAM's maneuvers that attempt to compromise the democratic international image of Guatemala. Although very similar threats preceded the murder of two leaders of GAM in March and April of 1984, the U.S. mass media entirely ignored this new information, despite strenuous efforts by GAM, the Guatemalan Human Rights Commission, and their allies to elicit publicity. As in the past, the unworthiness of these victims remains an essential ingredient in the Guatemalan Army's continued freedom to kill. Chapter 3. Legitimizing versus Meaningless Third World Elections, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. Third world elections provide an excellent testing ground for a propaganda model. Some elections are held in friendly client states to legitimize their rulers and regimes, whereas others are held in disfavored or enemy countries to legitimize their political systems. This natural dichotomization is strengthened by the fact that elections in the friendly client states are often held under U.S. sponsorship and with extensive U.S. management and public relations support. Thus, in the Dominican Republic in 1966 and periodically thereafter, the United States organized what have been called demonstration elections in its client states, defined as those whose primary function is to convince the home population that the intervention is well-intentioned, that the populace of the invaded and occupied country welcomes the intrusion, and that they are being given a democratic choice. The elections in El Salvador in 1982 and 1984 were true demonstration elections, and those held in Guatemala in 1984-85 were strongly supported by the United States for image-enhancing purposes. The election held in Nicaragua in 1984, by contrast, was intended to legitimize a government that the Reagan administration was striving to destabilize and overthrow. The U.S. government, therefore, went to great pains to cast the Nicaraguan election in an unfavorable light. A propaganda model would anticipate mass media support of the state perspective and agenda. That is, the favored elections will be found to legitimize, no matter what the facts. The disfavored election will be found deficient, farcical, and failing to legitimize, again, irrespective of facts. What makes this another strong test of a propaganda model is that the Salvadoran and Guatemalan elections of 1982 and 1984-85 were held under conditions of severe ongoing state terror against the civilian population, whereas in Nicaragua, this was not the case. To find the former elections legitimizing and the Nicaraguan election a farce, the media would have had to use different standards of evaluation in the two sets of cases, and more specifically, it would have been necessary for them to avoid discussing state terror and other basic electoral conditions in the Salvadoran and Guatemalan elections. As we will see, the media fulfilled these requirements and met the needs of the state to a remarkable degree. In order to demonstrate the applicability of a propaganda model in these cases, we will first describe the election propaganda framework that the U.S. government tried to foist on the media. We will then review the basic electoral conditions under which elections were held in the three countries. And finally, we will examine how the U.S. mass media treated each of these three elections. 3.1. Election Propaganda Frameworks. The U.S. government has employed a number of devices in its sponsored elections to put them in a favorable light. It has also had an identifiable agenda of issues that it wants stressed, as well as others it wants ignored or downplayed. Central to demonstration election management has been the manipulation of symbols and agenda to give the favored election a positive image. The sponsor government tries to associate the election with the happy word democracy and the military regime it backs with support of the elections, and hence democracy. It emphasizes what a wonderful thing it is to be able to hold any election at all under conditions of internal conflict, and it makes it appear a moral triumph that the army has agreed to support the election, albeit reluctantly, and abide by its results. The refusal of the rebel opposition to participate in the election is portrayed as a rejection of democracy and proof of its anti-democratic tendencies, although the very plan of the election involves the rebels' exclusion from the ballot. The sponsor government also seizes upon any rebel statements urging non-participation or threatening to disrupt the election. These are used to transform the election into a dramatic struggle between, on the one side, the born-again democratic army and people struggling to vote for peace, and, on the other, the rebels opposing democracy, peace, and the right to vote. Thus, the dramatic denouement of the election is voter turnout, which measures the ability of the forces of democracy and peace, the army, to overcome rebel threats. Official observers are dispatched to the election scene to assure its public relations success. Nominally, their role is to see that the election is fair. Their real function, however, is to provide the appearance of fairness by focusing on the government's agenda and by channeling press attention to a reliable source. They testify to fairness on the basis of long lines, smiling faces, no beatings in their presence, and the assurances and enthusiasm of U.S. and client state officials. But these superficialities are entirely consistent with a staged fraud. Fairness depends on fundamental conditions established in advance, which are virtually impossible to ascertain under the brief guided tour conditions of official observers. Furthermore, official observers in sponsored elections rarely ask the relevant questions. They are able to perform their public relations function because the government chooses observers who are reliable supporters of its aims and publicizes their role, and the press gives them respectful attention. Off the agenda for the government in its own sponsored elections are all of the basic parameters that make an election meaningful or meaningless prior to the election day proceedings. These include 1. Freedom of speech and assembly, 2. Freedom of the press, 3. Freedom to organize and maintain intermediate economic, social, and political groups, unions, peasant organizations, political clubs, student and teacher associations, etc. 4. Freedom to form political parties, organize members, put forward candidates, and campaign without fear of extreme violence. And 5. The absence of state terror and a climate of fear among the public. Also off the agenda is the Election Day coercion package that may explain turnout in terms other than devotion to the army and its plans, including any legal requirement to vote and explicit or implicit threats for not voting. Other issues that must be downplayed in conforming to the government propaganda format are the U.S. government's role in organizing and funding the election, the internal propaganda campaign waged to get out the vote, outright fraud, and the constraints on and threats to journalists covering the election. Another issue off the government agenda is the purpose of the election. If its role is to influence the home population, spelling this out might arouse suspicions concerning its authenticity. In the case of the Vietnam election of 1967 and the El Salvador elections of 1982 and 1984, the purpose of the elections was not merely to placate the home public, but also to mislead them on the ends sought. In both instances, it was intimated that an election would contribute to a peaceable resolution to the conflict, whereas the intent was to clear the ground for intensified warfare. Nobody who proposed a peace option could appear as a serious candidate in Vietnam in 1967, and as we describe later, there was no peace candidate at all in El Salvador in either 1982 or 1984, although the polls and reporters kept saying that peace was the primary concern of the electorate. This highlights both the fraudulence of these elections and the urgency that the intentions of the sponsor be kept under wraps. In elections held in disfavored or enemy states, the U.S. government agenda is turned upside down. Elections are no longer equated with democracy, and U.S. officials no longer marvel at the election being held under adverse conditions. They do not commend the Army for supporting the election and agreeing to abide by the results. On the contrary, the leverage the dominant party obtains by control of and support by the Army is put forward in this case as compromising the integrity of the election. Rebel disruption is no longer proof that the opposition rejects democracy, and turnout is no longer the dramatic denouement of the struggle between a democratic army and its rebel opposition. Now the stress is on the hidden motives of the sponsors of the election, who are trying to legitimize themselves by this tricky device of a so-called election. Most important, the agenda of factors relevant to appraising an election is altered. From the stress of the superficial, long lines and smiling faces of voters, the simple mechanics of election day balloting, and the personalities of the candidates, attention is now shifted to the basic parameters that were off the agenda in the sponsored election. As noted by Secretary of State Shultz, the important thing is that if there is to be an electoral process, it be observed not only at the moment when people vote, but in all the preliminary aspects that make an election meaningful. Spelling this out further, Shultz mentioned explicitly that for elections to be meaningful, rival political groups must be allowed to form themselves and have access to people, to have the right of assembly, to have access to the media. These remarks were made apropos of the 1984 Nicaraguan election. No congresspersons or media commentators raised any question about whether these criteria should perhaps be applied to the Salvadoran or Guatemalan elections scheduled during the same year. In brief, the government used a well-nigh perfect system of Orwellian doublethink, forgetting a criterion that has become inconvenient and then, when it becomes necessary again, drawing it back from oblivion for just so long as it is needed. It even acknowledges this fact. A senior U.S. official told members of the Latin American Studies Association, LASA, observing the Nicaraguan election, "The United States is not obliged to apply the same standard of judgment to a country whose government is avowedly hostile to the U.S. as for a country like El Salvador, where it is not. These people, the Sandinistas, could bring about a situation in Central America which could pose a threat to U.S. security. That allows us to change our yardstick." But while a government may employ a blatant double standard, media which adhere to minimal standards of objectivity and are not themselves part of a propaganda system would apply a single standard. Did the mass media of the United States follow a single standard in dealing with the elections in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua? Or did they follow their government's agenda in order to put the Salvadoran and Guatemalan elections in a favorable light and to denigrate the one held in Nicaragua? 3.2. Basic Electoral Conditions in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua, 1982 through 85. All three of these countries in which elections were held in the years 1982 through 85 were in the midst of serious conflict. Nicaragua was being subjected to regular border incursions by the U.S. organized and supplied Contras. El Salvador was in the midst of a combination civil conflict and externally U.S. organized and funded counterinsurgency war. Guatemala, as we noted earlier, had evolved into a counterinsurgency state with permanent warfare to keep the majority of Indians and other peasants in their place, and violent repression was structured into the heart of the political system. Despite the common feature of ongoing conflict, however, electoral conditions were far more favorable in Nicaragua than in El Salvador and Guatemala for several reasons. First, and crucially important, is the latter countries, at the time of the elections, the army was still engaged in mass slaughter of the civilian population, with the toll in the tens of thousands in each country, and the killing often carried out with extreme sadism. Nothing remotely similar was true in Nicaragua. These facts, which are not controversial among people with a minimal concern for reality, immediately establish a fundamental distinction with regard to the electoral climate. In countries that are being subject to the terror of a rampaging murder machine, supported or run by a foreign power, electoral conditions are fatally compromised in advance, a point that the media would recognize at once if it were considering the sphere of influence of some official enemy. A further and related distinction was that the ruling Sandinista government was a popular government which strove to serve majority needs and could therefore afford to allow greater freedom of speech and organization. The Lassa report on the Nicaraguan election notes that their program implies redistribution of access to wealth and public services. The state will use its power to guarantee fulfillment of the basic needs of the majority population. The logic of the majority, the report continues, also implies the involvement of very large numbers of people in the decisions that affect their lives. Qualified observers conclude that the Nicaraguan government pursued this logic, although this fact is excluded from the free press, after citing the World Bank's observation that governments vary greatly in the commitment of their political leadership to improving the condition of the people and encouraging their active participation in the development process. Diana Melrose of the charitable development agency Oxfam states that, from Oxfam's experience of working in 76 developing countries, Nicaragua was to prove exceptional in the strength of that government commitment. The Salvadoran and Guatemalan governments, by contrast, were ruled by elites that had been struggling desperately for decades to avoid the very kinds of reforms the Sandinistas were implementing. Extreme repression was the long-standing method of control of the majority in El Salvador and Guatemala, with vigorous and unceasing U.S. support. The aim of this repression was to keep the populace apathetic and to destroy popular organizations that might lay the basis for meaningful democracy. The Sandinistas were engaged in mobilizing the majority and involving them in political life, which they could afford to do because their programs were intended to serve the general population. A third factor affecting electoral conditions was that in El Salvador and Guatemala, the conflict was internal, and violence against the majority was integral to the struggle. In Nicaragua, the conflict was one involving an externally sponsored aggression that had very limited internal support. The Sandinistas could appeal to national sentiments, easily mobilized against Yankee-organized terrorism. The Salvadoran and Guatemalan governments could hardly do the same. The Salvadoran government especially had to contend with the negative nationalist reaction to obvious foreign U.S. domination and manipulation of its affairs, a fact that reached the level of absurdity when Duarte, visiting Washington in the fall of 1987, made himself an object of ridicule throughout Latin America by promptly kissing the American flag. While the Sandinistas did increasingly crack down on internal supporters of the Contras as the conflict intensified, by the standards the United States usually applies to this region, dissenters were dealt with remarkably benignly in Nicaragua. In El Salvador and Guatemala, the ruling elites could not afford such toleration, and repression by large-scale terror had long been institutionalized in these states. A fourth factor making for a more benign electoral environment in Nicaragua, paradoxically, was U.S. hostility and the power of its propaganda machine. Every arrest or act of harassment in Nicaragua was publicized and transformed into evidence of the sinister quality of the Sandinista government in the free press of the United States. Meanwhile, as we described in Chapter 2, the Guatemalan and Salvadoran regimes could indulge in torture, rape, mutilation, and murder on a daily and massive basis without invoking remotely proportional attention, indignation, or inferences about the quality of these regimes. In the context, the Nicaraguan government was under intense pressure to toe the mark, whereas the U.S. satellites were free to murder at will without serious political cost. Let us examine briefly how El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua compared in the individual categories of conditions of a free election, before we turn to the media treatment of these issues. 3.2.1 Free Speech and Assembly. In El Salvador, the right to free speech and free assembly was legally suspended under a state of siege order of March 7, 1980. Decree number 507 of December 3, 1980, essentially destroyed the judicial system, permitting the armed forces to hold citizens without charge or evidence for 180 days. Under these rulings, in the 30 months before the March 1982 election and prior to the 1984 elections, many thousands of civilians were seized, imprisoned, tortured, raped, and murdered outside of legal processes for alleged subversive actions and thoughts. The state of siege was lifted in early 1982 solely for the six parties contesting the election, and it was lifted entirely 10 days before the election for all Salvadorans, although unfortunately the citizenry was not informed of this fact until after the election was over and state of siege conditions were reimposed. The practice of exposing mutilated bodies for the edification of the citizenry became institutionalized in the early 1980s in El Salvador. We described in Chapter 2 the difficulty the U.S. government had in getting underlings jailed, tried, and convicted for the murder of four American citizens, even under intense U.S. pressure. The people of El Salvador had no protection whatsoever from the state terrorists, apart from that afforded by the guerrilla army in the regions under their control. The threat of extreme violence by the state against dissident speech was acute in El Salvador in 1982 and 1984 and was incompatible with a free election. In Guatemala, similarly, during 1984 and 1985, and for many years before, the actions of the armed forces against alleged subversives was entirely outside the rule of law. Thousands were seized, tortured, and killed without warrant and without any individual right to hearing or trial. As in El Salvador, mutilation and exposure of the tortured bodies became commonplace in the late 1970s and the 1980s. The courts were dominated by the military, as the latter would simply not execute or obey a court order of which they disapproved, and the judges were not inclined to challenge the military for reasons of dependency or fear. Even Viscount Colville of Curris, the special rapporteur of the UN General Assembly, who had been a notorious apologist for the Guatemalan regime, after pointing out that over 80 members of the judiciary, court staff, and legal profession had been murdered in the early 1980s, and that many others were threatened, says that such events make their mark and cannot quickly be mitigated. Two illustrations of the lack of court autonomy may be noted here. In May 1983, Ricardo Sagastume Vidaurre, then president of the Supreme Court, was simply removed by military order for attempting to bring military personnel under the jurisdiction of the legal system. On July 19, 1984, Colonel Jaime Dominguez, head of public relations for the Army, told the newspaper Prensa Libre that the Army wouldn't tolerate its members being taken to court on any charges. In the early 1980s, following the mass killings and village destruction of 1980 through 83, vast numbers of peasants were resettled in model villages and other places under army control, and over 800,000 males were made obligatory members of civil patrols with military functions under close army surveillance. According to the British parliamentary group that visited Guatemala in 1984, the civilian patrol system is implemented by terror and designed also to sow terror. People who do anything out of the ordinary come under immediate suspicion and are taken by the patrols to the Army's destacamiento. Interrogation will be done by the Army, but the killing of murdered suspects is often by the civilian patrols. Bishops Taylor and O'Brien, representing the Roman Catholic Bishops' Conference of Scotland and England-Wales, respectively, reported after their visit to Guatemala in 1984 that the civilian population is under almost total control by a heavy army and police presence throughout the country, which we were able to observe. There is also a nationwide network of civil defense patrols, military commissioners and informers, and model villages serving in some cases as internment camps for the Indian population from the areas of conflict. Much of Guatemala resembles a country under military occupation. One of our informants summed up the situation by saying that the military had established a system of structural control. The Inter-America Commission on Human Rights, following an on-site visit in May 1985, also found that freedom of speech and assembly did not exist in Guatemala. The right of assembly and freedom of association, considered in Articles 15 and 16 of the American Convention, are also restricted and curtailed because existing security measures in the development poles and the strict supervision of the civil defense patrols inhibit residents from taking part in any social, ideological, cultural, or other assemblies or associations. All such meetings, when they do occur, are subject to surveillance, supervision, and control by the authorities, so they do not enjoy the freedom implied by such rights. Public demonstrations were permissible in Guatemala during the 1984-85 elections, with 3 days' advance notice and approval of the military authorities. In the Guatemalan context, however, this grant of rights was not meaningful. The delegation of the International Human Rights Law Group and the Washington Office on Latin America noted that, whatever the election guarantees, the military and civil defense patrols and the climate of fear also made it difficult for many Guatemalans to organize and assemble. One local observer said that the years of terror and oppression against local organizations had demobilized the whole rural population. 4 CUC Peasant League members were killed in this village alone. Now it would be very difficult to organize any kind of group. Civil patrols, police, and army checkpoints on highways, and the need for travel permits for residents of the model villages impeded free movement. In the rural areas, the civil patrols discouraged gatherings because people feared being reported. It was noted by many observers of the Guatemalan elections that although the big issues in that country were land distribution and reform and human rights, no political candidates discussed or advocated either land reform or restructuring the military and forcing an accounting of tens of thousands of disappearances. One Christian Democratic advisor explained to the law group that we Christian Democrats haven't raised such issues because this isn't the moment to start a confrontation with either the army or the private sector. In short, despite the momentary improvement in the conditions of free speech that occurred during the election campaign, Guatemala did not meet the first condition of a free election. The rural masses were under army discipline and traumatized by mass killings and the absence of any vestige of rule of law, and the candidates were unable to raise openly the fundamental issues of the society. Free speech and rights of assembly were constrained in Nicaragua in 1984 by social pressures and threats and by a state of siege that had been terminated some 6 months prior to the November 1984 election. Very important differences existed, however, between the Nicaraguan constraints and those prevailing in El Salvador and Guatemala. Most important, in Nicaragua, the army and police did not regularly seize alleged subversives and torture and murder them. Mutilated bodies have not been put on public display as a part of the system of public education. What the law group called the constant overt political terror in Guatemala, based on numerous documented massacres of whole villages, and what the former Salvadoran official Leonel Gomez called the state of fearful passivity prevalent in El Salvador, did not apply in Nicaragua. In Nicaragua in 1984, dissidents were able to speak freely without fear of murder, and the LASA group noted that every member of our delegation was approached at least once by an irate citizen as we walked around Managua and other cities. Several of these encounters turned into heated arguments between the individual who had approached us and passers-by who joined the discussion. These people did not feel intimidated. Freedom of assembly in Nicaragua was somewhat limited by harassment, but once again, it was not ruled out by state terror, as was the case in El Salvador and Guatemala. The Lassa delegation examined in detail the charges of Sandinista harassment of opposition group meetings and found them largely unfounded, concluding that the contesting parties were able to hold the vast majority of their rallies unimpeded by pro-FSLN demonstrations. Our conclusion is that the first basic condition of a free election was partially met in Nicaragua, but was not met at all in El Salvador and Guatemala. 3.2.2 Freedom of the Press. In El Salvador, the only substantial newspapers critical of the government, La Crónica del Pueblo and El Independiente, neither by any means radical papers, were closed in July 1980 and January 1981, respectively, the first because its top editor and two employees were murdered and mutilated by the security forces, the second because the army arrested its personnel and destroyed its plant. The church paper and radio station were repeatedly shut down by bombing attacks. No paper or station representing the principal opposition has been able to operate except clandestinely. Over 30 journalists have been murdered in El Salvador since the revolutionary junta took power. An intensified campaign against the press occurred just prior to the 1982 election. On March 10th, a death list of 35 journalists was circulated by a death squad, and on March 18th, the mutilated bodies of four Dutch journalists were recovered. None of the murders of journalists in El Salvador was ever solved. They were essentially murders carried out under the auspices of the state. In Guatemala, 48 journalists were murdered between 1978 and 1985, and many others have been kidnapped and threatened. These killings, kidnappings, and threats have been a primary means of control of the media. As in El Salvador, nobody has yet been apprehended and tried for any of these crimes, which must be viewed as murders carried out by the state or with state approval. There are no papers or radio or television stations in Guatemala that express the views of the rebels or the majority Indian population or the lower classes in general. At most, the variants reflect shades of strictly conservative thinking. Given the extreme climate of fear and threats for stepping out of line, even the conservative press is cautious and engages in continuous self-censorship. All the central topics that should be debated in this terrorized society are carefully avoided. In Nicaragua, once again, there have been no reported deaths of journalists by state terrorists, nor even threats of personal violence. In 1984, the majority of the 50-odd radio stations were privately owned, and some of them provided their own news programs. Four other independent producers supplied radio news programs without prior censorship. Foreign radio and television from commercial and U.S. propaganda sources broadcasting from Costa Rica, Honduras, and elsewhere were of growing importance in 1984. Two of the three newspapers were privately owned, one supportive of the government but critical of specific programs and actions, the other violently hostile. The latter, La Prensa, which represented the small ultra-conservative minority and supported the Contras and a foreign-sponsored invasion of the country, was allowed to operate throughout the 1984 election, although it was censored. The censorship still allowed the paper to publish manifestos of opposition groups and a pastoral letter critical of the regime. No comparable paper has been allowed to exist above ground, even briefly, in El Salvador and Guatemala. There is no doubt that the media in Nicaragua have been under government constraint, with censorship and periodic emergency controls that seriously encroached on freedom of the press. It should be noted, however, that Nicaragua is under foreign attack and in a state of serious warfare. John S. Nichols points out that under the U.S. Espionage Act of 1917, over 100 publications were banned from the mails, and hundreds of people were jailed for allegedly interfering with military recruitment. Furthermore, given that the United States was a relatively mature and homogeneous political system during World War I and was not particularly threatened by the fighting, the range of public discussion tolerated in Nicaragua during the first 5 years of the revolution was remarkable. Despite assertions by President Reagan, IAPA, and others that the control of the Nicaraguan media was virtually totalitarian, the diversity of ownership and opinion was unusual for a third world country, particularly one at war. Our conclusion is that the condition of freedom of the press necessary for a free election was clearly absent in El Salvador and Guatemala, and that it was partially met in Nicaragua. 3.2.3 Freedom of Organization of Intermediate Groups. Perhaps the most important fact about El Salvador in the 2 years prior to the election of March 1982 was the decimation of popular and private organizations that could pose any kind of challenge to the army and oligarchy. As we noted in Chapter 2, this was the main thrust of policy of the revolutionary junta from late 1979 onward, and thousands of leaders were murdered and numerous organizations were destroyed or driven underground. The teachers' union was decimated by several hundred murders. The university was occupied, looted, and closed down by the army. Organized student and professional groups were destroyed by arrests and killings, and even the peasant union sponsored by the AFL-CIO, meaning supporters of the regime, had some 100 of its organizers and leaders murdered between October 1979 and the election of March 1982. In Guatemala, too, intermediate organizations such as peasant and trade unions, teacher and student groups, and professional organizations have been regularly attacked by the armed forces since 1954. The process of demobilization of institutions threatening the dominant elites culminated in the early 1980s, when by government proclamation, illicit association was made punishable by law. All groups which follow or are subordinated to any totalitarian system of ideology, evidently an exception is made of the Guatemalan armed forces and the national security ideology, are illicit. Only the armed forces determine when illicitness occurs. If General Mejia Victoris finds the GAM mothers to be agents of subversion, they may be killed. Refer to Chapter 2. Unions, peasant groups, student and professional organizations have grown up periodically in Guatemala, only to be crushed by systematic murder as soon as their demands were pressed with any vigor. The 1984-85 elections followed the greatest era of mass murder in modern Guatemalan history. Under the regimes of Lucas Garcia, Rios Montt, and Mieja Victoris, union membership in 1985 was below its 1950 level, and other urban groups were decimated or inactive. The peasant majority was totally demobilized and under the tight control and surveillance of the military. In Nicaragua, again, the contrast with the two U.S. clients is marked. Under Sandinista management, there was a spurt in union and peasant organization. A deliberate attempt was made to mobilize the population to participate in decision-making at the local level and to interact with higher-level leaders. Oxfam compliments the Nicaraguan government highly for this effort, as we pointed out earlier. There is legitimate debate over the extent to which the grassroots and other organizations sponsored by the ruling FSLN are independent and whether they might not be a vehicle for both state propaganda and coercion. Oxfam America and its parent organization in London clearly find them constructive. Luis Hector Serra contends that the grassroots organizations are relatively autonomous and that their close relationship to the leaders of the FSLN did not obstruct their capacity to express the concerns of their members at the local level. He concludes that the popular organizations were profoundly democratic in their effects of involving the populace in decision-making and educating them on the possibilities of participation in public life. The difference with the organization of the Guatemalan peasantry in Poles of Development, where the essence of the organization was, quite openly, military control by terror and enforced non-participation, is quite dramatic, whatever one's general assessment of the FSLN popular organizations may be. We conclude that, on the third basic condition for a free election, El Salvador and Guatemala did not qualify in the years 1984-85. Nicaragua did, at least to a significant degree. 3.2.4 Freedom to organize parties, field candidates, and campaign for office. No party of the left could organize and present candidates in the 1982 and 1984 elections in El Salvador. The Democratic Front, FDR, had been quickly driven underground. Five of its top leaders were seized in El Salvador in November 1980 by official and paramilitary forces and were tortured, mutilated, and killed. A year before the March 1982 election, the Army published a list of 138 traitors, which included virtually all politicians of the left and left center. Colonel Gutierrez, a powerful member of the junta, had stated forcefully that the FDR could not participate in the election because it was a front for the guerrillas. The invitation to the FDR and the FMLN to lay down their arms and compete in the election was thus fraudulent, a fact confirmed by the admission of the U.S. Embassy that the FDR could not safely campaign in El Salvador, and the accompanying suggestion that they might do so by means of videotapes sent in from outside the country's borders. Subsequently, even Duarte, the preferred candidate of the United States, was unable to campaign outside San Salvador in 1982 for fear of murder, and scores of Christian Democratic politicians were killed in the years 1980 through 84. In short, not only radical but even pro-U.S., mildly reformist parties could not escape decimation by political murder during those years. It should also be emphasized that no party could organize and run candidates in El Salvador that put high priority on terminating the war by negotiations with the rebels. What makes this especially important is that reporters and observers were unanimous in 1982 that the main thing the public wanted out of the election was peace. The propaganda formula for getting out the vote in 1982 was ballots versus bullets, with the implication that ballots were a possible route to a reduction in the use of bullets. If, in fact, no peace candidate was eligible to run, the election was a fraud for this reason alone. Defenders of these elections have argued that there was a substantial difference between the candidates, especially between D'Aubuisson and Duarte, so that voters had a meaningful choice. But D'Aubuisson and Duarte did not disagree on the central issue of interest to the Salvadoran people, whether to fight to win or to strive for a negotiated settlement with the rebels. Both were members of the war party, with only tactical differences. Although Duarte made occasional demagogic claims that he would talk with the rebels and bring about peace, he never spelled out a peacemaking agenda, never went beyond suggesting dialogue, as opposed to negotiations, which imply the possibility of substantive concessions, and never departed from the position that the rebels should lay down their arms and participate in the new democracy that Duarte and the army had established. Duarte joined the junta at a moment of severe crisis in March 1980, when all the progressive civilians had left and immediately after the murder of the Christian Democratic Attorney General Mario Zamora by the newly prospering death squads. It was clear that the army and affiliated death squads had embarked on a policy of large-scale massacre. Duarte provided the fig leaf and apologetics that the army needed for the second Matanza. We believe that Duarte never would have received U.S. support and protection and could not have survived in El Salvador unless he made it clear that he was in basic accord with the aims of the U.S. administration and the Salvadoran army. From 1980 onward, Duarte always accepted fully the pursuit of a military solution and no compromise with the subversives, a phrase that Duarte uses continually, just as do the army and death squad leaders. As Raymond Bonner points out, the repression in 1980 reached a magnitude surpassed only by the first Matanza and was far worse than anything imagined under General Romero. By the end of the year, the number murdered had reached at least 9,000. Every day, mutilated bodies, missing arms or heads, were found behind shopping centers, stuffed in burlap bags and left on dusty rural roads, hurled over cliffs into ravines. And through all of this, Duarte not only provided the facade of reform, he regularly complimented the army for its loyal service. In a letter published in the Miami Herald on November 9, 1981, Duarte wrote that the armed forces are waging a heroic battle against a cruel and pitiless enemy supported by great resources of ideological aggression. This goes parallel with armed aggression. This would be one more prey in the conquest plan in the Central American region that Moscow has designed to pursue. Immediately after that, its greatest reward would be the North American nation. In brief, the Salvadoran public was never offered the option that the press itself acknowledged the voters craved. In Guatemala, as in El Salvador, no parties of the left participated in the 1984 election for a constituent assembly, and only one crippled party made a tentative but wholly ineffectual foray in the 1985 presidential election. The main guerrilla movements were, of course, outside the electoral orbit. Their leaders would have been killed if apprehended, but they would not have participated anyway without a drastic alteration in basic social and electoral conditions. Even a centrist party like the Christian Democrats had suffered scores of murders in the years 1980 through 83, and the current president of Guatemala, the Christian Democrat Venicio Cerezo, survived three known assassination attempts. No seriously left party could have qualified in 1984-85 under the laws of illicit association mentioned earlier. The peasant majority was not represented or spoken for by any candidate. The Guatemalan Human Rights Commission, an organization not able to function within Guatemala, has pointed out that national political parties that speak for major groups like the working class or indigenous people do not exist, and as a result, these sectors are institutionally excluded from the political system. America's Watch states that one of the civil patrol system's functions is to provide vigilance and control of the local population, preventing any form of independent political organization. This exclusion of the peasantry from any political opportunity was reflected in two ways in the 1984-85 elections. One was that in registering for the election, only 3% of the electorate signed up as members of political parties. Another, more compelling, is that no candidate in the election urged land reform, although this was one of the two central issues in Guatemala, the other being unconstrained army murder, also not an issue in the election, given the understanding on all sides that the army will remain the ruling force, whoever gains office. As with Duarte in El Salvador, the presence of Venicio Cerezo as a candidate and as the eventual winner in the 1985 election raises the question of whether, despite constraints on the left, Cerezo did not really offer a significant option to the voting public. Cerezo differentiated himself from his electoral rivals, especially toward the end of the campaign and the runoff, by expressing compassion for the masses and a determination to make changes in the human rights picture and mass poverty. He occasionally mentioned the need for structural reform, although he was not specific and stressed that the first requirement was to reestablish civilian control. He was quite clear, however, that if he were elected, his power would be nominal at first and would have to be enlarged while he was in office. The election will not bring automatic transfer of real power to the president. There will be a handover of formal power. What are my chances of consolidating that power? 50-50. During the election campaign, Cerezo never straightforwardly addressed the question of land reform, and news reports in Guatemala suggested that he had promised the landowners' lobby that land reform was not on his agenda. Similarly, he did not promise any legal action against those who had murdered thousands, nor did he say that he would dismantle the counterinsurgency state. There would seem to have been at least a tacit understanding between Cerezo and the military that he would protect them against prosecution and preserve their power and relative autonomy. In fact, he could not do otherwise and survive. In the year and a half that has elapsed since he took office, Cerezo has made no meaningful move toward land reform and supported the army vigorously against any accounting, and has made no move to dismantle the civil patrols, the development poles, and other features of institutionalized terror. The human rights situation in Guatemala remains terrible, although improved, but partly because higher rates of killing are no longer deemed beneficial. The poor, for whom he expressed so much compassion during the electoral campaign, have suffered further losses in real income, as Cerezo's reforms have accommodated the demands of the army and oligarchy. He is on very poor terms with the mutual support group. Thus, the post-election pattern shows that Cerezo, in part by prior agreement but more decisively by structural constraints, has been entirely unable to serve his mass constituency. In the 1984-85 election, Cerezo gave the Guatemalan people an opportunity to vote for a man of seeming goodwill and good intentions, but one unable to respond to democratic demands opposed by the real rulers of the state. In Nicaragua in 1984, The spectrum of candidates was much wider than in El Salvador, Guatemala, or for that matter, the United States. The Conservative Democratic Party and the Independent Liberal Party both issued strong calls for respect for private property, reduced government control of the economy, elimination of press and other controls, and a foreign policy of greater non-alignment and accommodation. Both were able to denounce the Sandinistas for the war and to call for depoliticization of the army and negotiations with the Contras. Arturo Cruz, after lengthy negotiations with representatives of the government, chose not to run in the 1984 election. But this was a voluntary act of Cruz, albeit under heavy U.S. pressure, in contrast with the position of the left in El Salvador and Guatemala, and was not based on physical threats to his person or limits on his access to the populace. The FSLN had a strong advantage over the opposition parties as the party in power, defending the country from foreign attack and having mobilized the population for their own projects of development. The Lassa group felt that much of the incumbency advantage of the FSLN was characteristic of governments everywhere and concluded, "It seems clear that the FSLN took substantial advantage of its incumbent position and, in some ways, abused it. However, the abuses of incumbency do not appear to have been systematic, and neither the nature of the abuses nor their frequency was such as to cripple the opposition party's campaigns or to cast doubt on the fundamental validity of the electoral process. Generally speaking, in this campaign, the FSLN did little more to take advantage of its incumbency than incumbent parties everywhere, including the United States, routinely do, and considerably less than ruling parties in other Latin American countries traditionally have done. We would conclude that the ability of candidates to qualify and run, and the range of options, was substantially greater in Nicaragua than in El Salvador and Guatemala. Furthermore, as all major political groups on the left were off the ballot by threat of violence in the latter two cases, those elections failed to meet still another basic electoral condition. 3.2.5 Absence of State Terror and a Climate of Fear. During the years 1980 through 84, the death squads worked freely in El Salvador, in close coordination with the army and security forces. The average rate of killings of civilians in the 30 months prior to the 1982 election was approximately 700 per month. Many of these victims were raped, tortured, and mutilated. All of this was done with complete impunity, and only the murder of four American women elicited, by dint of congressional pressure, any kind of legal action. Even William Doherty of the American Institute for Free Labor Development, a longtime supporter of U.S. policy in El Salvador, asserted before a congressional committee that there was no system of justice operative in that country, while Leonel Gomez, a former land reform official in El Salvador, told the same committee a bit later that state terror had put the population in a state of fearful passivity. In Guatemala, too, the endemic fear based on years of unconstrained and continuing army violence was a dominant fact of national life. According to America's Watch, writing in early 1985, "Torture killings and disappearances continue at an extraordinary rate, and millions of peasants remain under the strict scrutiny and control of the government through the use of civil patrols and model villages. Guatemala remains, in short, a nation of prisoners." The Law Group described Guatemala in 1985 as a country where the greater part of the people live in permanent fear. In the case of Nicaragua, we repeat the central fact that differentiates it from the U.S. client states. In 1984, its government was not murdering civilians. The main fear of ordinary citizens in Nicaragua was one of violence by the Contras and the United States. Our conclusion is that the fifth condition for a free election was met in Nicaragua, but not in El Salvador and Guatemala. And our overall finding is that neither El Salvador nor Guatemala met any of the five basic conditions of a free election, whereas Nicaragua met some of them well, others to a lesser extent. 3.3. The coercion packages in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. As we noted, in the U.S. government's sponsored elections, voter turnout is interpreted as public support for the election and its sponsors. In disapproved elections, here Nicaragua, this frame is abandoned, and voter turnout is either ignored or declared meaningless because of limited options or coercive threats by the authorities. But the question of coercive threats should clearly be raised in all cases where this is a potential problem. As we have just discovered, the elections in El Salvador were held under conditions of military rule where mass killings of subversives had taken place and a climate of fear had been established. If the government then sponsors an election and the local military authorities urge people to vote, a significant part of the vote should be assumed to be a result of built-in coercion. A propaganda model would anticipate that the U.S. mass media would make no such assumption, and they did not. In El Salvador in 1982 and 1984, voting was also required by law. The law stipulated that failure to vote was to be penalized by a specific monetary assessment, and it also called on local authorities to check out whether voters did in fact vote. This could be done because at the time of voting, one's identification card, ID, cedula, was stamped, acknowledging the casting of a vote. Anybody stopped by the army and police would have to show the ID card, which would quickly indicate whether the individual had carried out his or her patriotic duty. Just prior to the March 1982 election, Minister of Defense Garcia warned the population in the San Salvador newspapers that the failure to vote would be regarded as an act of treason. And in the 1984 election, advertising by the government and military prior to the elections stressed the obligation to vote rather than the freedom to vote. Given the climate of fear, the voting requirement, the ID stamp, the Army warning, and the Army record in handling traitors, it is evident that the coercive element in generating turnout in Salvadoran elections has been large. This is supported by queries made by independent observers on the reasons why Salvadorans voted. In Guatemala, as in El Salvador, voting was required by law. Non-voters were subject to a fine of 5 quetzales, $1.25. Also, as in El Salvador, newspaper ads sponsored by the army asserted that it was treasonous to fail to vote or to vote null or blank. The law group reported that many people expressed fears that non-voting would subject them to reprisals, and after the military threats in the week before the election, there was a widespread belief that failure to vote would be punishable by more than the 5 quetzal fine stipulated by law. In Nicaragua, while registration was obligatory, voting was not required by law. Voter registration cards presented on election day were retained by election officials so that the failure to vote, as evidenced by the lack of validated voter credential, could not be used as the basis of reprisals. Most of the voters appeared to LASA observers to be voting under no coercive threat. They did not have to vote by law. They were urged to vote, but not threatened with the designation of traitors for not voting. There were no obvious means of identifying non-voters, and the government did not kill dissidents, in contrast to the normal practice in El Salvador and Guatemala. In sum, Nicaragua did not have a potent coercion package at work to help get out the vote, as did the Salvadoran and Guatemalan governments. 3.4. El Salvador. How the U.S. media transformed a deranged killing machine into the protector of an incipient democracy. In reporting on the 1982 Salvadoran election, the U.S. mass media closely followed the government agenda. The personalities of the candidates, the long lines waiting to vote, alleged rebel disruption, and turnout were heavily featured. As Jack Spence pointed out, every media outlet, particularly the networks, cast the election day story in a framework of voting in the midst of extensive guerrilla violence at polling places. Warren Hogue and Richard Meislin of the New York Times repeated day after day that the rebels were threatening disruption, Hogue asserting that the elections have taken on a significance beyond their outcome because leftist guerrillas mounted a campaign to disrupt them and discourage voters from going to the polls. This is a precise statement of the government's propaganda frame. But Hogue and Meislin never once cited a rebel source vowing disruption, and nobody else did either. On election day, no voters were killed or polling stations attacked, and the general level of rebel military activity was below average. In short, the disruption claims were falsifications of both plans and election day results, but as they fit the patriotic agenda, they were given prominence, repeated frequently, and used to establish the contest between the forces of good and evil. At the election day close, Dan Rather exclaimed, "A triumph, 1 million people to the polls. Rather, did not regard it as a triumph that the Sandinistas got 700,000 people to the polls, a higher proportion of the population, and without a voting requirement. The propaganda frame of the government gave turnout high importance in the Salvadoran election, but none in the Nicaraguan election, and Rather followed like a good lapdog. Neither Rather nor any other media analyst on or before March 30, 1982, noted that voting was required by law in El Salvador. And not one mentioned the warning by the defense minister, General Guillermo Garcia, in the San Salvador newspapers that non-voting was treasonous. The basic parameters were entirely off the media agenda. The destruction of La Crónica and El Independiente and the murder of 26 journalists prior to the election were unmentioned in discussing the election's quality and meaning. The army and its allies had been killing civilians on a massive scale in El Salvador for many months before and into March 1982. Would this not create a climate of fear and, in conjunction with the state of siege, somewhat encumber free debate and free choice? The point was rarely even hinted at in the mass media. Could candidates run freely and campaign without fear of murder? Could the rebels qualify and run? After all, if it was a civil war, the rebels were clearly the main opposition. Again, the mass media played dumb. They pretended that this exclusion was not important, or that it represented a willful boycott by the rebels rather than a refusal based on conditions unfavorable to a free election and a blatantly stacked deck. Neither the March 1981 death list nor the Gutierrez statement that the FDR would not be permitted to run were mentioned by the mass media in our sample. They never once suggested that the election plan was to create an electoral environment of extreme coercion and bias in which the rebels could not run, and then use this for the dramatic game of disruption and triumphant turnout. That the military agreed to the election because it couldn't lose was never suggested by these media. The role of the army was summarized by Warren Hogue in the New York Times. Is the military playing any role in the election? Members of the military are not allowed to vote, and the armed forces are pledged to protect voters from violence and to respect the outcome of the contest. We may note that the Army's mass killing of civilians and systematic destruction and demobilization of virtually all popular organizations in El Salvador over the preceding 30 months, which bears on what Secretary of State Schultz referred to as the preliminary aspects that make an election mean something, is not part of the Army's role for Hogue and the Times. Hogue repeats the Salvadoran Army's pledge, not only taking it at face value, but never suggesting that it and the election itself was meaningless in a terror state where the main opposition was off the ballot and only the war parties were able to field candidates. In the propaganda framework, the security forces of client states protect elections. Only those of enemy states interfere with the freedom of its citizens to vote without constraint. As noted earlier, observers and reporters in El Salvador all agreed that the populace was most eager for an end to the war, and government propaganda even stressed that voting was an important vehicle to that end. The public was urged to substitute ballots for bullets. But no peace party was on the Salvadoran ballot, and after the election was over, the war went on, and the death squads continued to flourish. This is in accordance with the hypothesis that the real purpose of the election was to placate the home population of the United States and render them willing to fund more war and terror. It is a poor fit to the hypothesis that the people of El Salvador had a free choice. An honest press would point up the failure of the election to substitute ballots for bullets. The mass media of the United States did not raise the issue. Nor did the experience of 1982 and its aftermath affect the media's willingness to follow the patriotic agenda once again in 1984. We will return to this later in a statistical comparison of the New York Times coverage of the Salvadoran and Nicaraguan elections. 3.5. First step, Guatemala opts for moderation. The U.S. government was less deeply involved in the Guatemalan elections of 1984 and 1985 than it was in those held in El Salvador, but as we heard in Chapter 2, the Reagan administration went to great pains to put a favorable gloss on the murderous regimes of Lucas Garcia, Rios Montt, and Mejia Victoris, and to attempt to reintegrate them fully into the Free World Alliance. It encouraged the 1984-85 elections, provided advisory and financial support for election management, and gave public relations assistance and sent official observers to help put the election in a favorable light. There was little effort made to disguise the fact that the purpose of the election, from the standpoint of the Reagan administration and the ruling army, was to alter the international image of Guatemala in order to facilitate aid and loans. With the administration supporting the new look, but without the intensity of commitment and propaganda backup brought to bear in El Salvador, and given the steady stream of reports of ongoing mass murder in Guatemala, a propaganda model would anticipate a media response that put the Guatemalan elections in a favorable light, but with qualifications. There was, in fact, far less coverage than the Salvadoran election. What there was had a little more balance, but the apologetic framework was still overwhelmingly dominant. A telling manifestation of bias was the media's ready acceptance of the Guatemalan elections as meaningful, even though they were admittedly for image-making, in a context of long-standing army rule and massacre, and despite new institutional arrangements in the countryside, the massive relocations of the population, the model villages, and the civil defense patrols that were, on their face, incompatible with a free election. In an enemy state where an election was held under comparable conditions, it would be designated a meaningless public relations exercise. In the case